You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Philip Yun. Here in the U.S., we've been transfixed by our electoral process and political discord, and the world has been watching. In his inaugural address, President Biden declared a victory for democracy.
Today, we celebrate the triumph not of a candidate, but of a cause, the cause of democracy. The people, the will of the people, has been heard. And the will of the people has been heeded. We've learned again that democracy is precious. Democracy is fragile. And at this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed.
But what is the state of democracy in 2021? And is the U.S. still a beacon for aspiring democracies around the world? This week, we're partnering with the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University, trying to tackle these very questions. FSI's director, Michael McFaul, will co-host this episode. But first, producer Teresa Katsourilis takes us back to another time when liberal democracy was at its strongest.
In 1989, Germans took to the streets en masse and helped tear down the Berlin Wall.
Thousands and thousands of West Germans come to make the point that the wall has suddenly become irrelevant.
The Soviet Union was crumbling. The United States was the largest superpower in the history of the world.
This is CNN Breaking News.
For over 40 years, the United States led the West in the struggle against communism and the threat it posed to our most precious values. The Soviet Union itself is no more. This is a victory for democracy and freedom. It's a victory for the moral force of our values.
And in this moment of Western triumph, Francis Fukuyama was working on his most famous political essay, The End of History. So this essay is still considered provocative today, and its title has a lot to do with that. No, Fukuyama says, he was not declaring that history was literally over in 1989. The end of history is a specific concept used by the philosophers Hegel and Marx.
Both of them had a concept of history that we would today use a different word for. We'd say development or modernization. And the basic question that they were asking is, where is the modernization process leading? What's the end point of that progress?
Marx thought human progress was inevitably evolving towards communism. But Fukuyama was watching the Soviet Union fall apart.
And I said, well, it doesn't look like we're ever going to get to that communist utopia. It looks like the penultimate stopping point, which was what they called bourgeois liberal democracy, was really going to be the last and highest evolutionary point of human societies. And that was the argument.
Liberal democracy. So the word liberalism gets thrown around a lot and frankly misused a lot. So just to nail down what Fukuyama's talking about here.
The liberal part really refers to the rule of law. You have to behave according to laws that are accepted by the rest of the community. It also means that the most important and powerful people in the society also have to live by those same rules.
No one is above the law. The rich can't just do whatever they want, and the government can't either. Everyone's basic civil rights are protected. According to Fukuyama, one of those basic rights is your right to own property. So liberal democracies also tend to embrace some form of capitalism.
I don't think that you can really have a liberal society without a market economy, because property ownership and property rights are pretty fundamental rights that a liberal regime tries to protect.
Liberalism, democracy, and capitalism don't always go together. You can have illiberal democracies, for instance, where people still vote in elections, but the government basically gets to do whatever it wants. But when these three concepts are combined, well, in his original essay, Fukuyama argues that liberal democracy just might be, quote, the end point of mankind's ideological evolution and the final form of human government. 30 years later, well, as you may have noticed, the world's liberal democracies have taken a few hits lately. Capitalism has its fair share of critics, too. Fukuyama is now at Stanford. He's the director of the Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law, and he's a senior fellow at the Freeman Spogli Institute. He's also spent the past few decades refining his position, and some of his work anticipates the crises we're facing today. When Fukuyama turned his controversial essay into a controversial book, he called it The End of History and the Last Man. He got that term last man from Nietzsche.
And this was his critique of what the end of history was going to look like, because he said basically people aren't going to have anything to aspire to. They're not going to have any pride in themselves. People want dignity. They want recognition. And if all they've got is peace and prosperity, then they're going to fight against peace and prosperity. And quite frankly, when I was watching that mob attack Congress on January 6th, you know, these were not desperately poor people that were at their wits' end and, you know, so trampled on by a tyrannical government that they had to do this. You know, in a certain sense, they're living at the end of history. You know, they're leading kind of ordinary lives, but many of them were living in a kind of fantasy world where elections are stolen and, you know, pedophiles are running the U.S. government. And in many respects, it struck me that this is the kind of thing that you get actually when you reach the end of history, that they didn't actually have a plan. They didn't have a concept for what the United States would look like that would make it better than what it was. They basically wanted recognition. They wanted somebody to look at them and to say that they were the true essence of what Americans should be. They were the patriots.
In the aftermath of the U.S. Capitol attack, Fukuyama sat down with his friend and colleague, Michael McFaul, to talk about liberal democracy's tenuous position in an unstable world. McFaul is a former diplomat and U.S. ambassador to Russia. He now directs the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford, our co-production partner for this episode.
Frank, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks very much, Mike.
So first, just at broad strokes, describe the state of the world with respect to liberal democracy. And then secondly, help us understand where we're at today compared to, say, 30 years ago.
Well, I think that the biggest attacks, we're actually facing multiple challenges to liberal democracy. So one of them is just a straightforward attack on democracy itself. So China today is up and coming. If it's not already the largest economy in the world, it may well be very shortly. And it is an autocracy. There are no elections. There's no pretense of democratic choice. In Russia, there is a pretense of democratic choice, but not the reality of democratic choice. And so I think these are actually pretty overtly authoritarian countries, and they've been trying to export their patterns of government to other parts of the world. And so that's a straightforward challenge against democracy. In countries that hold actual elections, like Hungary and Poland and the United States and other places, you're seeing the rise of illiberal democracy in which you have popularly elected leaders like Donald Trump, like Narendra Modi in India, like Viktor Orban in Hungary, like Kaczynski in Poland. And in all of those cases, you have reasonably free and fair elections that in the first instance have not challenged the democratic principle, but have challenged the liberal principle. So that's what Viktor Orban has done very explicitly when he says Hungary is an illiberal democracy. But what that means is really to try to undermine all of the check and balance institutions that constitutional orders try to erect in order to limit the power of governments. And that certainly happened, I think, under Donald Trump in the 4 years of his presidency when he went after the courts, he went after the bureaucracy, he went after the mainstream media. He went after his own FBI and Justice Department because his concept of the rule of law was that it was a kind of weapon that he could use against his enemies, but it wasn't something that really should be applied to him. And in many ways, that's what other populist leaders in other countries have tried to do. So in India, for example, Narendra Modi has been shifting the national identity of India from a pretty liberal one. That was the one that was established by Gandhi and Nehru in the late 1940s, to one that's based on Hindu nationalism. And so he has taken away the self-governing rights of Kashmir, a majority Muslim state, contested state in India. They passed a new citizenship law a year and a half ago that really took away citizenship from many Muslim inhabitants of India that thought that they were full citizens with full rights protected by the Indian constitution. There's no question Narendra Modi won the last election by a pretty large margin, so he's legitimately democratic, but he's been eroding the liberal part. I think, though, what happens over time is that once you erode the liberal features, then you start going after the democracy in the end. And this is, I think, unfortunately, what's going on now in the United States, where the Republicans have kind of realized, you know, in fact, Donald Trump said this quite explicitly. He said, if everybody votes in the United States, there'll never be another Republican elected. And therefore, you know, the contest has actually shifted away from the erosion of liberal institutions to actually the erosion of democratic ones as well.
That's pretty scary. That's where we're at. Not a pretty picture. You connected a lot of dots there just now. The rise of nationalism in many places and populism. Is there a global movement that we see here, or should we think about these in very specific cases? Dig a little deeper into what are the causes of what you just described.
Well, I think they're both global characteristics, but then every country is also unique in many ways. And so I think you really need to understand both. Now, the broadest generalization I would make is that there's been a shift in the nature of politics in many countries away from the 20th century alignment along an ideological axis that largely had to do with economic policy matters to an axis that is increasingly defined by identity. So this is what I mean by that. In the 20th century, the big fight was between a left that was socialist, that wanted a lot of redistribution, that wanted social protections in extreme cases of communism, wanted to abolish private property altogether in the name of the people. And then the right wanted greater individual freedom, protection of property rights, and in some cases, some conservative social values. But the real energy was in economic inequality or attempts to either reduce it or to protect the right of people to invest and to buy and to sell. Increasingly, that has gone away and has been replaced by a commitment to identity, which is really a cultural phenomenon where I believe that I have a certain inner worth that is not being recognized by the people around me, by other countries, by my fellow citizens. And it usually has to do with my membership in a particular group. So a nationalist is a great case of that, right? So right now there's lots of national movements in Scotland, in Catalonia, in other places that feel that they are not being adequately recognized and they demand recognition of their cultural identity. So that's one form that it takes. On the left, there's been a general shift in the understanding of inequality. So throughout the 20th century, inequality was defined in these broad class terms, you know, the proletariat versus the capitalist class or the bourgeoisie. But beginning in the late 20th century, inequality began to be seen as the province of particular groups, beginning in this country with the civil rights movement, with African Americans, and then expanding to women, to gays and lesbians, to transgender people, to the disabled, to indigenous peoples. And all of these were cases where a liberal society declared equality, you know, as in the Declaration of Independence, and declared that they were interested in equal rights for everybody, but they never lived up to those promises. And so you had terrible degrees of actual inequality in the way that the government treated people. The formal barriers, for example, to racial equality were swept away by the civil rights legislation of the 1960s, but as we've seen in the protest after the George Floyd killing, racial inequality still is a very deep and lingering problem. And so this failure of liberal societies to really live up to that promise, I think, has generated a different understanding of inequality, where it's related to the, you know, the particular indignities of each of these different kinds of identity groups. And this, in turn, I think, has spawned a kind of reaction or backlash on the part of the former majority identity group of the country. So increasingly in the United States, the two parties are really distinguished not by, you know, what distinguished them in the Reagan years, which was, you know, do you want free markets or do you want more regulation and redistribution? But now the Republican Party is increasingly the party of this kind of white backlash, and the Democratic Party is a collection of identity groups that are demanding greater inequality. And in my view, that's not a healthy development overall for liberal democracy, because if you're born a certain skin color or gender or as a member of an identity group, it's not something you have much choice over. And, you know, in a certain way, it's hard to negotiate those kinds of injustices. Whereas if it's just a question about who gets the bigger share of the economic pie, you know, do tax rates go higher or lower, you know, this sort of thing, there's much more room for kind of democratic discussion and compromise.
Right. That sounds very challenging to liberal democracy. Are there some political systems out there that you think are doing better than others in terms of reconciling those competing challenges that you just described?
Everybody has a different inheritance that were dealt. And yes, I think that some countries have actually done better. If you look at Northern Europe, they've managed to maintain, and by that I mean Germany, the Netherlands, Austria, the Baltic states, Scandinavia, and I would include Britain in this as well. They've managed to maintain a greater degree of social consensus around support for basic democratic institutions, and they've not ended up nearly as polarized as the United States. Now, there are other European countries that are highly polarized. Spain is very polarized over the Catalan issue and also over its kind of right-wing Francoist inheritance. Italy is, it's not polarized, it's split into like five different warring camps and so forth. But I think that, you know, if you do have that underlying social agreement, it's much easier to deliberate, it's much easier to reach a consensus in terms of, you know, sensible policies and the like. And it's really our misfortune that we've fallen into this high degree of polarization that really prevents our central government institutions from doing their job, like passing annual budgets and dealing with serious questions like, you know, climate and immigration and a whole range of other things.
Do you see evidence of demand for either liberalism or democracy? You know, we've been talking about the negative cases, but I'm also wondering, how does what's happening in Belarus, for instance, you know, the people seem to be doing some very courageous things for these ideas. Russia, after Mr. Navalny went back and was arrested, you've seen big demonstrations there. Myanmar now, after a coup, people are out demonstrating. What about like the, you know, societal preferences out there, Frank? How do you see the trend line, both just what are people thinking and then how are they acting to try to realize those preferences?
Well, I think that the spirit of 1989, you know, when you saw popular uprisings against many communist regimes, is not dead, because people really do not like to live under corrupt dictatorships. They want personal freedom. They want to be able to criticize the government and gather and, you know, travel and do things that people in liberal societies are able to do. And so we've seen that, you know, not just in the countries that you mentioned, but in Sudan and Ethiopia and Algeria and quite a few other places around the world. So I do think that there is a kind of universal desire not to live in a dictatorship. I think where we have trouble is in coming to an agreement on what replaces the dictatorship, you know, what the contours of a democracy look like, and also actually making democratic institutions work. So we're both familiar with the situation in Ukraine after two big popular uprisings, the Orange Revolution in 2004 and the Revolution of Dignity in 2013-14. And it was pretty clear that many Ukrainians really did not want to live in a Russian-style corrupt autocracy. But what they've had real trouble with is getting rid of corruption because, you know, unfortunately, there are many elites in Ukraine that basically see the government as a big piggy bank where they can enrich themselves and they're kind of heedless of any kind of larger public purpose. And that's a kind of enduring problem that that country has simply not succeeded in solving. And I think corruption becomes something that delegitimizes many democracies and also the failure to deliver basic social goods like economic growth, jobs, new opportunities. We just hit the 10th anniversary of Tunisia's revolution in 2010. They were the first country that's kicked off the Arab Spring when they kicked out Ben Ali, the dictator Ben Ali. But there's a lot of discontent in Tunisia right now because the successor democratic regime, although legitimately elected, still has not presided over economic growth. There's a kind of nostalgia for the Ben Ali days when there was an appearance of greater economic opportunity. And I think that's really one of the big failings of many would-be democracies. And so, yes, I do think there is a great demand to live in a successful free society. I think what we're lacking is, in a way, the institutions and the leadership and knowledge about how to get from a dictatorship to a functioning, modern, wealthy democracy.
Right. And that's not very well understood in other countries. How has your understanding of Western liberal democracy and its relationship to free market capitalism evolved throughout your own career?
Oh, that's simple. You know, I think I've moved to the left considerably on economic policy questions. I think that back in the 1980s and 90s, there was too much of an acceptance of what's been called neoliberalism. The way I define neoliberalism is basically it's not belief in a market economy. I mean, there's really no alternative to that. It's really an extreme form of free market economics that's associated with the University of Chicago and, you know, Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, where there is an intense hostility to the state and the belief that our economic growth problems would be solved if you just got the state out of the way of entrepreneurs and value creators. And I think that that was actually a very harmful doctrine. And I think that the full impact of this really hit me pretty clearly during the 2008 financial crisis, where the deregulation of financial markets that a lot of Democrats like Bill Clinton and Larry Summers had bought into in the late 1990s, I think directly paved the way for that kind of instability. And so I think that regulation, you know, is needed. And I think, you know, we really need to step up to that.
Two last questions, Frank. One about the United States and then United States' place in the world. So are there some prescriptions? Are there some reforms that if only our leadership would hear them, we could incrementally push our system towards greater democracy and greater liberalism? Or are the bigger structural conditions that you've already described so enormous that it's not that simple?
Well, yeah, I'm afraid it's not that simple. There's no end of reforms that have been suggested. Many of them, I think, would be a good idea. But in a way, we're kind of stuck in this, what an economist would call a low-level equilibrium, where because our politics is so screwed up, we can't reform ourselves because we can't actually agree on passing, let's say, the legislation that would clean up our voting rights or clean up the electoral system and so forth. And so we continue to be stuck in this very dysfunctional place. You know, ultimately, this is going to be solved through politics. And by that, I mean, ultimately, at some point, a coalition is going to arise that will have enough power to actually change things. That's the way political change happens in a democracy. And that depends on a lot of things. I think if, you know, you have some economic success, you know, that's something we didn't mention yet, that, you know, countries like New Zealand and Germany that have dealt with COVID relatively well have actually rewarded their leaders, Angela Merkel and Jacinda Ardern, with really good popularity ratings because people want effective government. And so if you had an administration that oversaw an economic boom where lots of people were getting jobs and going back to work, and you got COVID under control, that could generate a fair amount of momentum that then might carry you forward into a greater political consensus for doing kinds of reforms that are necessary. So actually, I do think that the Biden administration has a big opportunity in front of it. I mean, you can imagine actually a pretty favorable scenario whereby, you know, by the end of 2021, the economy is really running on all eight cylinders again, and the pandemic is fading in the rearview mirror. And that might create a different kind of politics. But as we all know, lots of things could go wrong in that scenario. And so it's not something I'm going to predict.
Right. Well, then my last question, Frank, is about America's place in the world. What do you think is the right mix of policies and strategies that the United States, the new Biden administration, should be using to advance democracy abroad? And particularly, I have in mind, how do we confront, engage with China as we compete with, you know, I think it's fair to say, an alternative system like you described that does offer other countries an alternative model of development. So what are your ideas for the role of the United States in promoting liberalism and democracy today?
Well, first of all, I just don't see how we can promote democracy in other countries unless we clean up our own act. And so I think the first priority is actually doing something to wind back the extreme polarization. And if you ask, how are you going to do that? That's a whole nother podcast.
We'll have you back.
In fact, several podcasts. But I do think that, you know, if American democracy doesn't look better than it's looked in the past few years, we're not going to succeed in spreading, you know, that model very far. You know, I think that it is a mixture of means. I am perhaps a little bit more hawkish than you about China, because I do think that we've got a multidimensional problem there that is political, it's ideological, it's cultural, but it's also military. And we may be forced into making some pretty difficult decisions, for example, about whether we really are willing to defend Taiwan if it is threatened overtly by China. And I do think that, you know, there's a deep ideological division that means that, you know, we of course do not want to unnecessarily provoke and annoy China, but, you know, we do have to realize that their system represents some fundamentally different values than the ones that we hold dear. And we need to figure out how to work better with our allies rather than fighting everybody simultaneously, you know, if we're going to deal with China. It's really a geopolitical problem because everybody can sense the weakness in the United States. You know, the United States is so divided. There's a good third of the United States that basically thinks that the current president is illegitimate. And unless we can heal that wound, everybody's going to see that, you know, whatever we commit ourselves to, we may not stick to, because in another 2 years, there may be a different Congress. In 4 years, there may be a different president. And then every commitment that we've made then goes out the window the way it did over the last 4 years. And that, I think, is an ongoing vulnerability.
Having read a lot of your writings over the decades, I think a lot of it stands the test of time, by the way. And even thinking about what we were just discussing about identity politics, you can read about Fukuyama's writing about that 3 decades ago. But I'm curious, what has surprised you over the last 3 decades? What are some events that contradicted some analytic assumptions that you had made earlier on in your writings?
Well, I guess what's happened in the United States in the last 4 years has probably been the biggest thing that I just didn't anticipate, because I always had this idea that the American people were basically sensible and that they could make a mistake, you know, in one election, but they would figure out how to correct that and they would come back to, you know, more reasonable kinds of positions. And I'm really not sure that that's the case any longer. And indeed, the commitment of Americans to basic democratic principles, which I thought had been tested during the Great Depression and was rock solid, I'm not so sure that that's the case any longer. And so therefore, the kind of inevitable wisdom of crowds and wisdom of democratic choice as inevitably leading to better outcomes is something that I, you know, really no longer take for granted.
That is very sobering, and we'll have to come back to that question, I think, over the years and decades to come. Thanks again, Frank, for joining us.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, First Republic Bank, and Chevron. I'm Philip Yun. This episode was co-produced with the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Many thanks to Michael McFaul, FSI's director, for co-hosting. I highly recommend his podcast, World Class. You can find it along with the World Affairs podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Before we go, I want to take a moment and acknowledge that we just lost someone special. On February 6th, iconic statesman George Shultz died at his home in Stanford, California. He was 100 years old. George was an inspiration to the idea of a life well lived. He served a string of Republican presidents from Eisenhower to Nixon to Reagan, and played a pivotal role in shaping U.S. foreign policy at the height of the Cold War.
We provided ideas. We provided leadership. We provided direction. We provided a certain amount of muscle, and a lot got done.
George wasn't always perfect, but he was a devoted public servant, and a remarkably effective one. He was also a long-standing co-chair of the World Affairs Advisory Committee, and participated in more World Affairs programs than we can count. Thank you, George, for all you've done for us. We will miss you. Finally, we want to hear from you. What did you think about the program? What topics would you like us to cover in the future? Our email address is feedback@worldaffairs.org. This episode was produced by Jared Sport and Teresa Katsourilis. Joanne Jennings is our executive producer. Temba Daniels and Tatum Sanderbeck provided research support. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Philip Yun. Thank you for listening.